You may be seated. I invite you to turn to the back of your bulletin where you will find the conclusion to the Christmas story that's usually left out. How many of you, when you heard the children's sermon, thought of Simeon and Anna? All right, good for you. A few, and I'd expect a few would, and if I gave you more opportunity, many more of you would as well. But oftentimes, we leave Simeon and Anna out, and we throw in the wise men, and they're not there for a couple of years. So we leave out what Luke gives us, because he wants to round out the Christmas story. He wants to bring it to its rightful conclusion. He wants to end it where it began. He wants to end it in the temple, just as it began with Zechariah and Elizabeth. And he wants to end it with Mary and Joseph going back to Nazareth, just as they first heard the word from the angel in Nazareth. One of the reasons that these seniors are often left out of the story, I would suggest, is they're old. And we live in a modern culture that worships at the fountain of youth. We really have very little space for old. Now, those of us who have a respect for old use better words for old because old sounds so old. So we have words like seniors and the seasoned and the mature and the vintage, but our culture's not so kind and forgiving. Our culture speaks of the elderly as over the hill, as past their prime, as being no spring chicken anymore, as the old gray mare that ain't what she used to be. All of those things describe Simeon and Anna. And yet, the Christmas story is incomplete without them. Because Luke wants us to know this story began at the temple. It began with two old faithful saints who were given the promise of the birth of John, which would be the forerunner for Jesus. And it ends in the temple with two faithful, devout saints, Simeon and Anna. And the reason why it begins and ends with old faithful is we're shown that the promise of new life is arising from that rich soil of the old, from the tradition, from the religion of Israel at its best, not at its worst, because everything can be abused, but at its very best, all these prayers and rituals and traditions and customs are meant to create people who are at home in the temple and led by the Spirit and sensitive to what God is doing, longing for the fulfillment of God's promises. These two people, Simeon and Anna, are pure examples of religious devotion, not religion in decay. And it's the same with Mary and Joseph. They're the young expression of that. They're immersed in the religious rituals of ancient Israel. In that first paragraph alone, they perform four religious acts. They circumcise Jesus, which is to identify him with the covenant people of Israel. They then name him, giving him the identity of Jesus. They then go through the ritual of purification of the mother and then the dedication of the firstborn son to God. Four rituals in one paragraph, which allow us to see these are people 8 days after Jesus is born that are dedicated to the religious tradition, that are committed to their faith, and yet they're impoverished. If you look at the final phrase in our first paragraph, the sacrifice they offer is a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons because we have an impoverished couple. They have very, very, very little by way of means, but they have very much in regard to faith. One of the things that Luke wants us to see in chapters 1 and 2 is that you have a whole cast of characters, Zechariah, Elizabeth, Joseph, Mary, and now Simeon and Anna, that are models of devotion, that are deeply committed and also deeply religious. Now, some say, and you'll see this rise about every year or so, it just gets a buzz for a while, that Jesus wasn't religious. Even one of my favorite theologians, Karl Barth, had nothing good to say about religion, defining it as solely and only a human work. But every once in a while, you'll see someone, and they'll get all kinds of attention because they're going to say, hey, it's not about religion, it's about relationship, as if those two are incompatible. As if you're either religious or you have a relationship with God, but you can't have both. I always find that misguided because Jesus was devoutly religious. He attended synagogue with his family. Throughout his ministry, you find him at synagogues. He goes to Jewish festivals. He never condemns public religious practice, for that is what religion is. It's spirituality in public. What he does condemn is the abuse of public religion, like hypocrisy and shallow and hollow and empty practices. But as shocking as it might sound to our modern culture, you can be both religious and spiritual. You can be righteous and devout. Those are not incompatible. And in fact, when religion is done at its best, it forms people who are spiritual and devout and hopeful and confident that God's promises are sure. We don't have to set one against the other. The first, religion or righteousness, is meant to nurture spiritual depth, to nurture faith, hope, and love. And that's exactly what it's done with Simeon. Years and years of religious ritual and tradition and prayers and psalm singing and sacrifice and tradition, years and years of these have shaped him to be a man that we read about in verse 25. Now there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon, and here's his description. This man was righteous and devout. He was religious and spiritual, and he's looking forward to the consolation of Israel. He is looking for that which the prophet said, comfort ye my people. That God is going to come in God's time with the promise of God that will bring comfort and consolation. Simeon, who is an aged saint, is not captive to the temptations of the aged. The two most common temptations, nostalgia and cynicism. He's not caught up in seeing the past through rose-colored glasses, so the present can never be as good as the past. That's nostalgia. And he's also not caught up in that bitter cynicism that comes from that, which is that hopeless stance, looking into the future, seeing it getting worse and worse all the time. Instead of being caught up in those temptations, he's righteous and devout, and he looks forward with great hope that God will fulfill God's promises to God's people. And God rewards him for such hopeful expectation, in that the Holy Spirit, we're told in Luke's gospel, leads him into the temple. Not by coincidence, but at the right time. And when he's at the temple performing his normal religious duties, just like we all are here today, God visits him. God, in the form of Christ, comes. And Simeon holds this one in his arms, and he breaks out in song. Verse 29, Master, now you are dismissing your servant in your peace according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation, which you've prepared in the presence. And here's where the old takes a new twist. The presence of all peoples, a light for revelation to the Gentiles first, he says, before he says anything about Israel, and for glory to your people, Israel. Here is a man so shaped by his Jewish tradition, he's able to look forward in hope and say, the Messiah has come, I'm holding Messiah in my arms, and this one will be a light for all. He's able to look forward and understand when the angel said, I bring you good news of great joy for all the people. He's already absorbed that truth without actually hearing the angel's song. But before he's done with Mary and Joseph, he does have a sour note to bring to this occasion, which is always true if we're dealing with the Bible carefully, that in the midst of the good news, there's always an edge to the news. So in verse 34, Simeon blessed them and then says to Mary particularly, this child is destined for the falling and the rising of many in Israel, and a sign to be opposed, so that the thoughts of hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too. That's some bad news in the midst of all this celebration. But the bad news is there because Mary is going to uniquely share in the rejection of Jesus. You know why? It's obvious. She's his mother. She's going to have to watch her child prematurely and unjustly crucified. So we must never forget, and Simeon reminds us, and he's the only one in the Christmas story that does remind us there's an edge to this good news. There is a challenge to our hearts. There's a challenge to reception in saying that the same Mary who cradled the Christ in her arms will also cradle her crucified son at Calvary. That's bad news in the midst of the good news. But here's the good news in the midst of the bad news. The bad news never eclipses the good news. That's why the bad news, Christ is rejected, is never overthrown by the good news that Christ in his rejection will accomplish for the world the salvation of all. The bad news is Christ died. The good news is Christ died for our sins. So that the bad news even carries within it and inherent good news. So he offers that, and we must offer that, or we're not dealing adequately with sin and the awareness that the coming of Christ calls for our hearts to be changed and to be shaped in ways that are much like Simeon and Anna. Well, we come to the end of Simeon's interaction with Joseph and Mary, and we read in the end that he is ready to die. Verse 29, I always think of Fred Sanford. You know, Elizabeth, I'm coming to you. I'm ready to come home. Although this is much more holy and devout. Master, you're dismissing your servant in peace. He's ready to say, much like Red said to me on Tuesday, I'm ready. I'm ready to go home. I've had a good life. I've lived well. I trust that God's love embraces me. And here Simeon says, I'm ready. And what we find in Simeon is this beautiful example of enduring hope and living faith until the very end. But Simeon isn't nearly as interesting to me as Anna here at the end, because you have Anna who is ready to break out and preach to everyone in the temple. Simeon's word is specifically to Joseph and Mary, and then the last bit specifically to Mary. But Anna is there to preach to all. And so we find Anna, and she is 84 years old. She married and then was with her husband, it says, for 7 years. And then for quite a long time, she was widowed. It had not been an easy life for her. She went without a husband for very, very many years. And instead of living in bitterness and cynicism and nostalgia, she dedicated herself to the Lord's work, faithfully serving with worship, prayer, and fasting. We read in verse 37, she never left the temple. There are a few folk in our church like that. You'll find them all the time. They just are willing to be part. And then if they're not here at church, they're doing that in their communities or in their places of retirement, that they are committed and devoted to visiting and serving and loving and praying. Their faith is in action even though their years are going on. So Anna comes and she is full of energy. And at that moment, verse 38, she comes and she praises God and she speaks about the child. And I love this phrase, to all who were looking for the redemption of Israel. So she basically just starts proclaiming in the midst of the temple, this female prophetess preaching the gospel that the Messiah has arrived and he's right there. And any that are looking and living in hope for God's promises to be fulfilled, they can take heart in that that has begun in the coming of Christ. It's not till then that in verse 39 the Christmas story ends. 8 days after Christmas, they'd finished everything required by the law of the Lord. Again, an emphasis on their obedience to the commands. They return to Galilee. Joseph and Mary go back to Nazareth where they began. And the child grows and becomes strong, filled with wisdom. The favor of God is upon him. Why is Luke so committed to beginning and ending the Christmas story with seniors? I think the answer is very simple. He wants to connect the future hope with this rich soil of the past. He wants his readers to understand that the Christ who is coming from the midst of some devout, faithful, hopeful believers, and most of them, other than Joseph and Mary, are seniors. That the hope of the world is arising from these senior moments of faithfulness that represent for us pure religious devotion, because these seniors are embodying the story. They've lived with these promises longer than anyone else. You know, it's easy to have faith when you're in your teens and you have just this amount of life experience, and then in your 20s and 30s. But when you can have enduring faith for 70, 80, 90 years, you start showing that there's some proof in the pudding. You start showing that there's some real hope that is there, because no matter how long you live, those years are going to be full of sorrow, challenges, disappointments, and yet the faith continues and the hope endures. Simeon and Anna represent for us the best picture of devotion. They have a deep faith. They trust in the promises. They sustain and nurture that faith by a commitment to religious practices, the rituals, the customs, the traditions. And those traditions do what they're supposed to do. They make them spiritually sensitive enough that when they see just this simple child, they can begin to rejoice in hope. It was just a child. They didn't see a miracle. They didn't hear a voice from heaven. There were no signs or wonders. And yet, simply seeing this child was all they needed to know God's promises are in effect because of that spirituality, that deep spiritual sensitivity that had been formed by religious practice. They also have this deep and abiding hope. Both are looking forward to the consolation of Israel, looking forward to the redemption of all people. They have this hope, not just being optimistic or positive, but this confident expectation that God's promises are as sure as God is faithful, and that God will bring about what God has promised, no matter what arises. You do realize when we come to the end of this story, nothing's changed for Simeon and Anna. It's not as if Herod has been taken off the throne. He's still on the throne. Caesar still rules, so that their world is still full of oppression and still full of sin and challenges and trials. And yet they hold a promise and a hope so dear, even though neither of them will live to actually see Jesus do any ministry. Neither of them will live long enough to ever see all that the promise really involves. They'll be dead long before Jesus even begins. And yet they stand in grateful wonder, holding the future in their hands, having touched it from a distance, and they're satisfied. And the simple point I want to make this morning is that their faithful commitment to their tradition has allowed them to have a living hope that something new has arisen from the old, because faith and hope have been so deeply woven into their characters. The older they got, the more devout they became. They are the perfect example of being religious and spiritual, of righteous and devout. Not jaded, not bitter by time. They had opportunity. Poor Anna was a widow for many, many years. There's plenty of opportunity for bitterness, plenty of opportunity to be jaded. And yet the promise of God sustains them. And in our story, these old seniors shine. They shine. And they shine not because I would guarantee they have the best energy level. The older I get, the more I know energy level diminishes. They're not shining because they have all kinds of accumulation and possessions. They're shining because even though their bodies are old in years, their spirits are young in hope. They are people who love the past, but their hearts are set in the future. They understand that the best times are still before them and before all of God's people, for God's promise is sure. We need people like that. And the good news in this congregation is we have people like that. We have people that live by faith, that long to grow, that even in their latter years are hungering and yearning to have a deeper faith and a more living hope, that are committed to the tradition and the beauty of the past, but not so committed that they're unwilling to see something new arising in the future because God's given them a sensitivity to that. We need people like this, and I tell you, my aspiration in life is to be a person like that. I want to be like Simeon. I want to be like Anna. I want to have a lifelong enduring hope and faith, because that's what inspires Mary and Joseph. When they head back, when they go back to Nazareth, I can assure you they were encouraged by seasoned faith. They were encouraged by the hope and the faith of Simeon and Anna, by these two elders. We often hear this, and I close with this. We often hear stuff like this: the young are the future of the church. The young are the hope of the church. And that's true to some extent, but we have no idea how the young will turn out. We just don't know. They haven't had the years of experience to know if that faith is going to be deep and if their hope will endure. I think in Christ's church, it's never just one group that's the hope of the church. It's the church that's the hope of the church. And therefore, it's not just the young, that's too short-sighted. The seniors, the elderly, the aged, the vintage, they are the hope of the church as well, for they are the ones who carry faithfully and have carried the longest the hope and faith that inspires us all. They're the ones that produce. Religion does not have to produce nostalgic cynics, but can shape and form people of enduring, inspiring hope and faith. May that be true for our community. May that be true for us. I want to give the prayers of the people, but before I do, I've waxed eloquently about how religion and tradition can shape us in good and wholesome ways. This Wednesday in Matthew 23, we'll see the opposite, how religion can be abusive and hurtful and dysfunctional in so many ways, so that it can take us in one of two directions. Let's hope it goes in the right direction. But if you're interested in the darker side, this Wednesday is your sermon. Will you pray with me?